always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem. And again, we thank you for making some time for today's conversation. We've got a great hour ahead. Ted at the controls, I don't know if you ever heard statements like, the children should be seen, not heard.
I've heard of that
You've
one.
Heard that? Okay.
I was never told that one.
So I was thinking, well, maybe, our parents' generation had a little trouble with hearing or something. So that,
yeah.
And probably clothing sizes. That was always a problem. You're too big for your britches.
Oh, right.
It's like, well, it was just, I did have a problem. My mom ordered it from catalogs and never quite seemed to know what size I was.
Yeah.
No, Mom, that, no.
Didn't you tell me about high water pants or something?
Oh, yes,
one time?
Sure. Yeah. Turns out that... being a 30 waist and a 32 length doesn't look quite so good if you get a 32 waist and a 30 length pants. So
like, get those numbers mixed up.
Yeah, but that's what they have belts for.
That's
I guess.
Right. Yeah, so, make anyway. It work.
And that back in the day, you wore your colored socks to match your shirt. So,
oh, sure.
So it was a.
I want to see photos. Right.
We're going back in the day today. I'm excited to introduce today's guest because we're going to review some parenting from a generation or two ago. In fact, the title of the book we're referencing is called "Grandma Was Right After All: Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days." And we always wonder, were they the good old days? We'll find out. Today's parents are all but completely disconnected from the common sense parenting wisdom of their parents and grandparents. And we're going to address it today with John Rosemond, who has worked with families, children, and parents for more than 40 years in the field of family psychology. He's a best-selling author of, I think, some 20 books, parenting books, including The Well-Behaved Child and Parenting by the Book. And John and his wife, Willie, have two grown children and seven well-behaved grandchildren. And I'm kind of excited to talk to him because he's self-described himself as an old fogey. And I thought, we need more of those around. John, welcome to Connecting Faith from one old fogey to another.
Yeah, from one old fogey to another. thanks for having me on your show, Neil. I appreciate it.
I'm interested to know if this practical parenting wisdom from the good old days, about grandma. Is this a real grandma, or is it just kind of a composite of a belief system?
Well, I mean, it is a composite of sorts. The parenting aphorisms that I talk about in the book, which you've already mentioned several of them, were very common to parenting in the 1950s and before. Children should be seen and not heard. You're acting too big for your britches. You must think the world revolves around you. The fair comes once a year, this kind of thing. And one of the things that I point out to my audiences all over the country, I'm a very busy public speaker as well as an author, is that we don't talk this way to children anymore because we don't think the same way these people did when it comes to children and child rearing. We have completely radicalized, reformed, if you will, our understanding of children and our understanding of parental responsibilities. And in the course of this radicalization, which took place primarily in the late 60s and early 70s, we lost a point of view that had defined parenting in Western civilization for thousands of years since Abraham and Sarah, its founders. And we have replaced that point of view with a new psychological point of view that has no place for things like you're acting too big for your britches and children should be seen and not heard, which by the way, it's very interesting. And this is one of the things I cover in the book, Neil. Because we are two generations removed now from the use of these aphorisms, today's parents misunderstand them. And so in each case, I think I cover 25 or 26 in the book. In each case, what I do initially is explain very carefully what the aphorism actually meant and put it into a proper context and then explain why it was so valuable to parent and child both and why we should resuscitate these things.
Well, in fact, maybe just as an example, in the chapter you're talking about, you know, children should be seen but not heard. I mean, you talk about when you're speaking someplace, you invite people to raise their hands if they think that's a good idea, and then you sort of put it in modern terms, and you get quite a different reaction.
Yeah, nobody raises their – well, nobody. People my age will write, you know, I'll say, raise your hand if you agree that under certain circumstances, children should be seen and not heard. And the only people who raise a hand are people our age, Neil.
Yes.
And then I have people put their hands down, and I say, okay, how about this? If a child is in a room otherwise occupied by adults who are having conversation, it is right and proper for the child to pay attention and not do anything that would attract attention to himself. Raise your hand if you agree with that. And everybody raises their hand. And I say, look, I just said the same thing twice. You know, in the first instance, it was 10 words or less. In the second, I basically had to explain what the first example meant. And when I explained it, you guys agreed with it. And this is part of the problem, is that these old-fashioned parenting aphorisms were very concise. They didn't waste words at all. And for that reason, today's parents are likely to have sort of perceive them as kind of blunt and almost mean and harsh. But, you know, in fact, they weren't. When I was told, when we were going over to someone else's house, my parents were taking me along to a dinner party. Of course, the children would be fed in a different room at a different table when people had good common sense about those things. My parents would say, now, you know that when the adults after dinner get together in the living room and talk, you can sit there, but you know the rule. And I would say, yeah, I have to be seen and not heard. It was no problem at all, because by agreeing to be seen, in other words, I could stay in the room but not heard, I was able to listen to these fascinating conversations that went on about topics that I otherwise wouldn't have had any access to whatsoever. So it really it broadened my education considerably.
Well, and it really represents, I guess, boundaries or borders, right? I mean, that's kind of, I guess, sort of the heart behind it, right? Or is it maybe?
Well, the heart behind a lot of these aphorisms involved the idea that there was a boundary, not just a physical boundary, but an emotional boundary between parent and child. Example of that, you made this bed, you're going to lie in it. Another example, I'm going to let you stew in your own juices about this. In other words, in both cases, the parent is saying to the child, you've created a problem for yourself, and I'm not going to participate in it. You're going to have to deal with this issue on your own. You created it. It's your issue, and I am not going to be your partner in this. And it was really you as a result of this, and each one of these aphorisms, you know, reflects an attitude. And the attitude was that you are responsible for yourself. When you do something wrong, when you make a bed, I'm not going to lie in it with you. You're going to have to lie in it by yourself. If you don't like something that's happened to you, you're going to have to stew in your own juices. I'm not going to feel your pain anytime you have pain. And these were very important lessons that I think, Neil, enabled us to be a sturdier generation. And what I'm trying to do in the book, you know, I'm not just waxing nostalgic. I'm trying to help people understand that the parenting attitude that prevailed prior to the psychological parenting revolution of the 60s and 70s was a more functional attitude for parent and child, that it caused children to be sturdier children. And the proof of that is that we, our generation, we emancipated successfully by the time we were 21, 22 years old. And we were not looking at that point for our parents to help us pay bills. And today's kids, statistically, are still living at home well into their late 20s, quite frequently. And this, to me, this is a canary in the coal mine. It says, you know, we're not doing what we need to do in parenting to make America a continuously strong place to be.
You know, if the attitude behind these is that you are responsible, what was the attitude behind this sort of new psychological approach? Or, you know, somebody from the East Coast Ivy League with a PhD decided that there's a new way of doing things? Was it just because it was new and different and it was the 60s and we wanted to throw off the old ways?
Well, Mila, I'm very qualified to answer the question because I'm licensed as a psychologist in the state of North Carolina. I will tell you, however, in the listening audience, that my licensing board, the North Carolina Psychology Board, they truly regret the day they ever gave me a license because I go around the country and I tell the truth that there are statistics that clearly indicate that psychology has caused more problems for the American parent, the American child, the American marriage, the American family, and therefore America, than psychologists even know how to solve. You know, psychologists believe children are born fundamentally good, sinless, unstained, which is, of course, the opposite of a biblical understanding. And psychologists believe in behavioral or parental determinism. In other words, they believe that any aberrant behavior on the part of a child can be traced back to some aberrance on the part of his or her parents. And so what that does is, and this is quite often the unspoken purpose of psychological therapy, is to absolve the person of guilt or complicity in his or her own problems of living. Whereas a biblical understanding is you are responsible for yourself. And the earlier you accept that responsibility, the better.
Fascinating insight from John Rosemond, who's in the worked in the field of family psychology for more than 40 years and written some 20-plus books, including Parenting by the Book and The Well-Behaved Child. And the book we're referencing is called Grandma Was Right After All, Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days. And as Corey Robertson says from Duck Dynasty, the world would be a better place if more parents listened to John Rosemond. Well, you have an opportunity to listen to him today, and you can interact with us. There may have been a phrase that, you know, mom or dad passed on to you as a child, and it shaped your life in a positive way. We'd love to hear about it. And obviously we want you to sign up for one of the books that we have to give away, because this will be a great resource. It might give you some fresh perspective on how you're parenting, and or maybe grandparents want to give it to the kids as well. Maybe slip it in their, you know, their Christmas stocking or something. I'm not sure. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number. 877-933-2484. Again, we've got a couple of copies of the book to give away, and we'll talk more with John Rosemond in just a moment. Stay tuned. We're talking about children today and how we can provide some practical parenting wisdom from the good old days, because as the title of the new book suggests, Grandma Was Right After All, written by John Rosemond. It's one of his latest. John's been in working with families, children, and parents for more than 40 years in the field of family psychology and a best-selling author. And this great new resource is out from Tyndale. We've got some copies to give away, and you could sign up for that. We'll do a drawing at the end of the hour at 877-93-FAITH. We know the fifth commandment, of course, honor your father and mother, that your days may be long upon the land of which your Lord, the Lord your God gives you. And we're talking about, you know, how we honor parents and how parents can be more effective and perhaps even more biblical in their parenting. Hopefully those two should go together. Let's start with the first one, John, you address, Because I Said So, and be interested to know your perspective. What's good or bad about that approach?
Because I Said So is simply an affirmation of parental authority, and the legitimacy of that is affirmed in Scripture when Paul says to children, obey your parents in all things. He does not say, obey your parents if they give you a good explanation. Obey your parents if they give you good reasons. He says, obey your parents in all things. And I tell parents all over the country in churches, which is where I primarily speak, that your authority as a parent is derived from God's authority and assigned by God. You are acting as his proxy in the raising of his children, and he wants you to exercise a proper authority over your children as he exercises a proper authority over us.
You don't really recommend the idea of trying to reason with a child, do you?
No, I do not. I mean, the whole idea, here's what parents are doing when they try to reason with children. You know, they make a decision. A parent makes a decision, the child reacts negatively to it, demands to know why the parent has made the decision in question, and the parent begins to explain him or herself to the child, trying to get the child to say what no child has ever said, ever in history, which is, you know, Mom, I can't help but agree with you, but now that you've explained this so clearly. It's never happened. It's never going to happen. And which is why the explanation leads almost invariably, Neil, to an argument between parent and child. And so parents come up to me all over the country and they say, oh, John, I've got an argumentative child. And I say, no, you really don't. You've told me a lot about yourself. You've told me very little about your child. Your child is really no different than any other child. What you've told me about yourself is that you explain yourself to your child. And that invariably leads to argument between parent and child. If you don't want to have arguments between parent and child, you simply make decisions. And when the child says, well, give me a reason, you go, the reason is because I said so. And that's the only reason you're getting until you're paying your own bills. And I mean that, Neil. I mean a child of 17, 18 years old. It is perfectly legitimate for a parent to say to a child, 17, 18, as long as I'm paying your bills, I do not have to justify to you any decision that I make.
And you tell a lot of stories about, you know, your own children thinking, you know, I probably would have been irritated a time or two as your kids were with some of the decisions that you made without their reasoning or involvement.
You know, my son, the older of our two kids, we have a son and a daughter, both in their 40s now. He called me during his second year of college and he said, Dad, you know, the way I was raised, it really irritated me at times. It caused me anger at times because nobody else was being raised that way. But now that I'm in college and I'm able to see the consequences of how various people were raised, I'm beginning more and more to appreciate what you did for me, and that's why I'm calling. So, you know, I tell people, if you're trying to make your child happy today, you're probably making a lot of mistakes. If your goal is to produce a sturdy, responsible human being, this human being is probably not going to realize fully the value of the gift that you have given him or her until they are adults.
Well, and as you address, too, just almost kind of a side note, but there's some trickle-down effects to this, too, right? I mean, in terms of because I said so, if we assume we have to reason with one another all the time, then employment becomes difficult as kids grow up in this system.
Well, anywhere you find people in authority who believe that they are obligated to explain themselves to the people that are in the chain of hierarchy below them, you find people who are not good managers. You find people who create disruption in the workplace, who create confusion, who create communication problems, who create conflict. These are basic leadership principles, Neil, and parenting is a leadership function. The Bible tells us that it is a leadership function, that we are to lead, disciple our children properly. And the same principles that apply to leadership in any context apply to leading children. You speak clearly, you speak concisely, you don't explain yourself, and you use an economy of words. And one of the things I point out to my audiences is that description that I just gave does not describe the typical American parent. The typical American parent uses a lot of words, very wordy, gives lots of explanations, and then turns around and complains that children are disobedient and children are argumentative. And one of the things that I do is when I'm working in small groups is train people in these leadership principles and how they translate to parenting. And it's amazing. Within a week, people will be calling me and saying, John, it's already working. It's just amazing the transformation that this has brought about in our household in a week. But, you know, all I'm doing, Neil, I mean, this is not, you know, as well as I do, I'm not saying anything new. I call myself the great parenting plagiarist because all I'm doing is reaching back into the past and pulling this stuff up into the present and trying to help people understand that these are principles, that they still work today as well as they worked 75 years ago, 50, 75 years ago. Our listeners might be interested to know if they have any skepticism about any of this, and I'm sure that some do, that statistically, the mental health of children raised in the 1950s, the evil 1950s, when children heard, because I said so, children will be seen and not heard, you're acting too big for your britches, and so on and so forth, and had to eat everything on their plate because children were starving in Europe. The mental health of those children was 10 times better than the mental health of today's kids.
We're going to pick up more on some of those important statements and talk about the economy of words, just a few statements that carried a lot of weight, had a lot of impact. Grandma was right after all, practical parenting wisdom from the good old days. It's the latest book from John Roseman. We've got some copies to give away at 877-93-FAITH. Love to have you join the conversation as well, 877-933-2484. John Roseman, best-selling author, worked in family psychology for some 40 years now, and there's more to come.
Stand up straighter when you walk a place for everything, and everything must be in place. Stop crying or I'll give you something real to cry about. Oh! Brush your teeth, wash your face, put your PJs on, get in bed, get a hug, say a prayer with Mom. Don't forget, I love you. And tomorrow we will do this all again because your mom's work never ends and you don't need the reason why.
Is that Renfro?
Nita Renfro.
Nita Renfro, yes. Yes.
There it is. I said so.
Sure. That's right. We got it in there. We're talking about some of those statements, and not just statements, but they were really principles of parenting that, you know, our grandparents' generation used without any question. Grandma was right after all. That's the title of the new book from John Roseman called The Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days. John has written some, I think, 20-plus books. He's been working in the field of family psychology, helping families, children, and parents for a number of years. I heard him not too long ago on a Homeward broadcast talking about homework assignments, a pretty fascinating conversation. We may want to try and get into that as well before the time is gone. But, John, maybe let's just jump to one of the other ones because it's just kind of fun to work through something we sort of alluded to earlier about you made this bed, now you're going to have to lie in it. And obviously, it's not about housekeeping, but There's another one about, you know, give him enough rope and he'll hang himself. Why don't you, you know, that sounds a little stark. Let's talk about those two.
Like I said, they were all very, very concisely expressed.
Yeah.
I knew if I gave you enough rope, you'd hang yourself. Well, what that meant was that parents, even if they had strong indication that a child was doing things that were problematic, didn't necessarily jump in, intervene, and try and prevent the child from getting into trouble, whether it was at school, in the neighborhood, wherever, because they felt that the child needed to learn by trial and error, pretty much on his own, with a safety net, of course, but pretty much on his own, that he had to take responsibility for his own behavior. And so whereas the image of if I knew if I gave you enough rope, you'd hang yourself, sounds pretty stark. It really, all of these aphorisms were in the final analysis extremely beneficial to children. I don't think you'll find anybody our age who complains about hearing these things. Now, I will say one exception. I have had parents tell me that they felt like their parents said because I said so far too often. And yeah, you can begin to sound like a broken record with any of these things, which is why I say to parents concerning because I said so, you know, after you've said it four or five times, all you need to say to the child who's just asked why or why not is, I've already answered that question a number of times and don't intend to answer it again, and turn around and walk away. And that is better, by the way, I think, than beginning to sound like the proverbial broken record. But, all these things were very beneficial. You didn't know as a child how beneficial they were going to be to you as an adult. But as an adult, you began to slowly realize that, first of all, these aphorisms reflected a point of view, reflected a parenting philosophy, and that your parents had nothing but the best in mind when it came to you, and that this philosophy that they embraced, which was a biblical parenting philosophy, and that's another subject, but this parenting philosophy was very beneficial to you. Along those lines, Neil, a parenting sociologist determined that up until the psychological parenting revolution of the 60s, that's what I call it, that even people, even American parents who were not people of faith, raised their children according to biblical principle. The way that we raised children in America prior to the 1960s, there was consensus concerning child rearing. There was unanimity. There was agreement. And the agreement, there was agreement between your parents, agreement between your parents and teachers, agreement between your parents and neighbors. And I maintain the only parenting paradigm that leads to ubiquitous agreement of this sort is a biblical parenting paradigm. And that's what I'm trying to do as I travel around the country, is just, you know, help restore a biblical understandings to the raising of children.
And as you talk about, I mean, the Bible has the long rope principle on a number of occasions, giving us a chance to, you know, be discover the truth, that be sure our sins will find us out, and, you know, and God's not mocked. We reap what we sow. Some of those concise statements. Maybe just share an example of your own experience growing up, and then I know you've had, you've helped your son learn a few of those lessons as well about, his yeah. associations.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the Bible first, though.
Okay.
The long rope principle starts, you first read about it. It's not described that way. And American in Western civilization's first parenting story, which is Genesis chapter 3, where God says to his first two children, this is the rule. There's only one rule. This is it. And then he turns around and walks away. And he knows what's going to happen. And yet he walks away anyway. He doesn't stand there next to the tree of knowledge of good and evil saying, no, you're getting a little bit too close. What have I told you about this? Come on, back away. Don't listen to that thing that's crawling around here. If you listen to him, you just go off in the wrong direction. You know, he's the perfect example of a parent who is not a micromanager, who is going to insist that his children take full responsibility for the decisions that they make. This plays out in many stories I hear from parents our age, people our age, Neil, about their childhoods. I started running with a bunch of guys my senior year in high school, and these guys were trouble, but they were cool. And, the way I thought of cool back then was guys who, sort of flaunted their general disdain for authority. And to make a long story short, we ended up getting arrested for disturbing the peace. And my parents, there were like 10 of us in the police station. And the police sergeant was calling each kid's parents one at a time, got to mine, and my parents, of the 10, the only parents who did this, told them to keep me. So I was in jail for two nights when I was 17 years old. My parents came and got me on Saturday morning, and I, to this day, believe the only reason they came to get me on Saturday morning was because that was the day that I had to mow the lawn, and they didn't want to mow the lawn, so they came and got me out of jail. And did I like this? No, I thought, what weird people. Of the 10 guys who were arrested, I'm the only one who has to spend two nights in a jail cell with no privacy, no mattress on the cot. I don't think I slept for 48 hours. And again, this is an example of your children don't appreciate quite often what you do for them when they are children. But, I look back, Neil, and I thank my parents for saving me from even worse consequences, because I will tell you, and many people in similar who found themselves in similar situations as kids will reiterate this, if my parents had not done what they had done, what they did, I probably would have taken this another step further, and then another step further, and then another step further, and who knows what my life would look like today.
You know, that, which brings up, I guess, one of the common arguments that we hear from a child. It's not fair. Life isn't fair. Talk about the importance of affirming that life is indeed not fair, and the fair only comes once a year.
There was a commercial during the break about Joseph, and I was thinking, life certainly wasn't fair for Joseph, wasn't fair for Job. You know, if we read the Bible properly, we see that this is a lesson that's repeated many, many times in Scripture. And, of course, these stories all have multiple meanings, but one of the meanings of those two stories is, in fact, life isn't fair. There are no guarantees. You can be a good person, and things don't always work out well. And this is, it's a very valuable lesson for kids. All my friends can go to the mall and stay out until midnight. Why can't I? Well, because I said so. Well, that's not fair. Well, the fair comes once a year. When it gets here, I'll let you know. And it's a very What I'm trying to help parents understand is that this is a very casual approach to parenting. It is not necessarily an approach that is going to be popular with your child, but then parents shouldn't be trying to be popular with their children anyway.
Well, in fact, you kind of address that. Is much of parenting advice today, is it geared to make the parent feel better or to help the kids mature?
Exactly. Precisely. I mean, it's a, you know, the most of the parent, I don't mean this narcissistically, but I really do believe that 99.9% of the parenting advice that's floating around there in the parenting marketplace, and there are some notable exceptions, but it's worthless. And it creates problems. And I think that this is why, this being that we have been listening to people with capital letters after their names tell us how to raise kids. And I'm, you know, I can say this with credibility because I'm one of them. This is why parenting has become so stressful. You know, mothers will come up to me, Neil, and they'll say, oh, John, you know, parenting is the hardest thing I've ever done. And I say, how many children do you have? Well, I have two. Well, how many did your great-grandmother have? And there'd be a pause. Well, I think she had 10. And I'll say, well, do you think your great-grandmother ever felt that way, that this was, that raising children was the hardest thing she'd ever done? And the answer is no, she didn't feel that way because she had a complete confidence of the legitimacy of her authority. When you have a complete confidence in the legitimacy of your authority, your approach to parenting can be very casual, comfortable, and infused with a sense of humor. The reason that parents today are under such stress is because they don't have complete confidence in the legitimacy of their own authority, and they don't realize that this lack of confidence stems back to the general demonization of authority wherever one found it that took place in America in the 1960s, the demonization of political authority, military authority, authority in the church, and so on and so forth, and authority in the home.
Talking with John Rosemond today. John has spent the past 40 years or so working in the field of family psychology, working with families, children, and parents. He's a best-selling author of a number of parenting books, including The Well-Behaved Child and Parenting by the Book, and has appeared on numerous national TV and radio and print opportunities. He's with us today on Connecting Faith to talk about his new book, Grandma Was Right After All, Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days. There's some more to talk about here. In fact, in a moment, we're going to talk about pants size. Get into talk britches, not a word you probably are using in your regular vocabulary these days. We'll dive into that and more, get some things about maybe punishment and chores and drama queens, all that ahead. 877-933-2484 is our phone number if you'd like to interact with us. And for sure, wanted to have you call in, sign up for a copy of the book. We've got three copies to give away. It's a great resource. You'll enjoy it. And read it and pass it on to a friend. 877-933-2484. More in a moment.
Train up a child in the way he should live. Give him the tools that he needs to grow.
48 past the hour. Talking today about child rearing that took place a generation or two ago and some of the lessons that we need to reintroduce and remember and not forget, because Grandma Was Right After All. That's the title of the new book from John Rosemond, Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days. John is working in the area of family psychology and a best-selling author and speaker. He and his wife have two grown children, seven well-behaved grandchildren, and his kids, you know, survived childhood, and they grew up to actually, you know, thank him eventually. But one of the things that you talk about is sort of the idea about being too big for the britches or getting those right size. You also talk about being a little fish in a big pond. So maybe just talk kind of about those concepts, because we live in a world that's pretty interested in self-esteem.
Yeah, most people, you know, again, Neil, we're two generations removed from biblically based parenting, you know, a consensus surrounding biblically based parenting. And so it's, difficult for today's young parents to realize that the term self-esteem did not enter the vernacular until 1967 with the publication of a book that became a bestseller. The book was titled The Psychology of Self-Esteem. 3 years later, Dorothy Briggs, who is an acolyte of Thomas Gordon, a psychologist who wrote a best-selling book, Parent Effectiveness Training, wrote a book titled Your Child's Self-Esteem. And suddenly, you know, in contemporary terms, the idea that high self-esteem is a good thing that everyone should aspire to and that we should try and help children develop went viral in American culture. And today I start talking about self-esteem being a corruption. And people sit there, look at me like I'm from another planet speaking, a language that is incomprehensible. And so what I do is I use this example. I'll say to people, well, raise your hand if you believe high self-esteem is a good thing. We should do everything we can to help our children acquire it. And everybody raises a hand. I say, now, you are given a choice between living next door to a person with very high self-esteem or a person who's humble and modest. Raise your hand if you'd rather live next door to the person with high self-esteem, and nobody raises a hand. And I point out that, as the Bible says, we have understandings written on our hearts. The first question went to the head, tapped into what people have heard for the last 50 years. So people have heard high self-esteem is a good thing. So I asked that question. People raised their hands. The second question went to the heart, the organ of common sense. And suddenly, when people are put in touch with the proper question, with their common sense, they realize, oh, no. Humility and modesty are the preferable attributes, not high self-esteem. And, of course, that is verified in the truth of Scripture time and time again. I say to people, you know, Jesus did not say, blessed are those who think highly of themselves and promote their own accomplishments. Time and time again, Jesus addressed himself to the need to be humble and modest and to not promote yourself and to not promote your accomplishments and to not promote acts of charity on your own part, and so on and so forth. And this was the ideal back in the 1960s. I'm a member of the last generation. You and I, Neil, are members of the last generation of American children whose parents were determined to try and keep any tendency or inclination toward high self-esteem on a very, very tight leash, which is why we heard, you're acting too big for your britches and you're just a little fish in a big pond. Keep it in perspective. Keep yourself in proper perspective. You must think the world revolves around you. One of the things that I point out is that Jesus is so very adamant about the need to keep humility and modesty a value and to not slip into a high self-esteem culture is because high self-esteem is the root of sin. It is the root of the very, very dangerous relativistic notion that you are entitled to decide for yourself what is right and what is wrong. And the minute an entire culture agrees that the individual is free to decide for himself what is right and what is wrong, the culture tips and begins sliding downhill. And that's what we've been doing since the relativistic 1960s when this idea went viral.
Which, just kind of as a side point, you talked about, I think, at one point in the book about, you know, animals are fully grown in 2 years. Humans take, you know, 20 plus. I mean, clearly we don't want to be dealing with, 150-pound, 6-foot 2-year-olds. But kind of feels like we're moving that direction sometimes.
Well, you know, more and more you hear about, you know, children 8, 9, 10, you know, as old as 14, 15, 16, who are still exhibiting pronounced toddler characteristics. Again, people in young parents of this generation don't clearly understand that 60 years ago, by the time a child was three, attention deficit disorder had been cured, oppositional defiant disorder had been cured, and bipolar disorder of childhood had been cured. And I say that quite pointedly to point out to people that when you look at the diagnostic criteria for these very, very disingenuous, deceptive diagnoses, every single diagnostic characteristic describes typical toddler behavior. And this is sin in its purest form, is the toddler demanding that everything go his way and insisting that the rules don't apply to him and insisting, in effect, that he is free to decide for himself what he will and won't do and what is right and what is wrong. And by the age of three, 60 plus years ago, these characteristics had been pretty well cured. And this is why from age three on, the discipline of a child was a relatively simple, uncomplicated, regarded as such, proposition, and why it was so successful. My first grade class, Neil, the picture shows 50 children, that's 50, one teacher. I have met women who taught in the 1950s, 65 first graders, 70 first graders, 85 first graders, the record so far, one classroom, one teacher, 95 first graders. We could only be taught in these oversized classrooms like that because we came to school well-behaved. We came to school having already developed a healthy fear in the biblical sense of adults.
John, we've only got about 90 seconds left, and a lot more we could talk about. I'm just saying, would there be one step that a parent could take today to help raise an authentic adult in a little youngster in their home?
Well, I think that the best thing for parents to understand is that, and I say this, and it's an ironic thing for me to be saying because I've written 20 books, many of which are bestsellers in the genre. But the only parenting book we really need in the final analysis when all is said and done is the Bible. And the Bible is a parenting masterpiece. There are many, many nuggets of wisdom concerning parenting that relate to parenting, that apply to parenting, scattered throughout Scripture. And the interesting thing is that a lot of these, as I point out in my book, Parenting by the Book, like Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 1, there's a time for everything, a season, every purpose under heaven, don't say anything explicitly about children, and yet they apply to children. So my advice to parents all over the country is, get back to the original parenting book and the only parenting book that we really, in the final analysis, need.
Wise advice from John Rosemond, who has been in this field for 40-plus years and spends his time speaking and writing frequently and has given us a great new resource. It's called Grandma Was Right After All, Practical Parenting Wisdom from the Good Old Days. It's from Tyndale House. John, kind enough to join us today here in Connecting Faith. If you missed part of today's program, hopefully you want to hear part of it again and pass it on to a friend. You can do that by going to our website, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page to find the audio archive.